Hi guys, just a reminder that this podcast, as well as many of my online resources, is delivered freely. If you would like to help me get this message of healing out to millions of people around the world, please consider clicking on the donate button on my website, thecureforchronicpain.com. Thank you. Hello, hello, hello. Welcome to the podcast. How are you? This is Nicole, and you have reached my podcast, The Cure for Chronic Pain. With me, Nicole Sachs, it is great to be with you. I have such a treat for you today. It was such a treat for me. Hopefully, it will be an equal treat for you. I have my dear friend and colleague, Lisa Schlossberg, on the podcast today. Lisa is a licensed master social worker. She is a personal trainer and a mind-body health coach, and so much more. She's just like a weird, brilliant child savant, which you will hear when, as per our conversation. I'm just going to leave that right there. But Lisa's wonderful, and Lisa has been on this podcast two times prior. We've talked about her work. We've talked about her journey through her IBS. And today, we kind of brought it all together with a conversation that she helped me call. Well, she called it, and I was like, yes. What happens after the after picture? And so important about all chronic illness and conditions. And she gets really specific also about irritable bowel disease and about body image issues and our relationship with food, but it really applies to everything. So seriously, do not count yourself out if you do not identify as someone who has body image issues or issues with food or irritable bowel, because it's about everything. Lisa is also one of my Omega instructors, which means she will be with me at the Omega Institute in August 1st through the 6th. And that is going to be such an incredible experience because we have not been able to be in person for, as you know, all year. And we were supposed to be there together at Omega last summer. And of course, the world completely closed, which we were not prepared for. But if indeed you want to join us, I know that Omega's website will be up in April. They're redoing the whole thing, but they are reserving spots for the retreat right now. And it's going to be a limited capacity because they're still trying to follow COVID protocol. So if you're interested in joining Lisa and I and all my other guest instructors from August 1st through the 6th at the Omega Institute in upstate New York, please call 845-266-4444. That's 845-266-4444. Okay. Also, if you want to work virtually, May 21st through the 23rd is my virtual retreat. All information on my website, thecureforchronicpain.com. If indeed you want to find Lisa after hearing this brilliant interview with her, I don't even know what kind of openings she has to work with people. I do know that she is pretty full up with her one-on-ones, but she also does groups. Go to lisaschlossberg.com, Lisa, S-C-H-L-O-S-B-E-R-G.com, or find her on Instagram at lisa.schlossberg. Okay. Seriously, this is like such a fun conversation. First of all, it's so obvious how much we love each other and how much fun we have talking, but also there's some incredible wisdom being dropped here. Really, like she had me wowed several times. So I really look forward to sharing that with you. All right, without further ado, I give you my conversation with Lisa Schlossberg. You ready? Because we're going to record it now. You ready?
Yeah, I'm ready.
We're recording it.
We're doing it.
Okay. So hi, guys. Here I am, Nicole Sachs, and welcome to Lisa Schlossberg. Hello, Lisa.
Hello.
Now, Lisa is my buddy. She is also my colleague. She is also one of the instructors that comes with me to the Omega Institute, and she is also a now three-time guest on this podcast. And so when I contacted her this past week to get her back on, it is because of this. It is because Lisa and I have a lot of different reasons to connect, but I would say every like 6 weeks, I will get a text from Lisa and it will be something like, oh my God, this work, you have no idea what's happening. Oh my God. It's just awesome because she's over on the other side of the country. Literally, I live where I could touch the beach on the East Coast. She lives where she could touch the beach on the West Coast. And she is living this life of doing this work, my work that she learned when we met, for herself and having revelation after revelation. So I basically just said, come back on the pod and let's talk about what's been going on, what's your journey been telling you. And when we just right before we jumped on the air, I said, Lisa, what are we talking about today? And Lisa said,
what I said was, what comes after the after picture? We have we live in a before and after world, and I've experienced a lot of that myself. And I think what we're here to talk about is what happens after the after picture, because we don't stay there. I didn't stay there. That's what we're here to talk about.
And we're not meant to stay there because there's no cure for the human condition.
Yep.
Yeah. There's only a cure for chronic illness and chronic pain, because chronic illness and pain are an epidemic of fear. But once you get knowledgeable about what's going on and you do the work to get you out of the hole, what is this journey? What is the deeper work and the deeper meaning? So Lisa, kind of, I'm just going to open it up for you to kind of tell me how it's been going for you and what you were thinking when you said that. What happens after the after picture?
Yeah. So to catch up anyone who hasn't heard me speak before or the other two podcasts, the long story short is that before I met Nicole, I lost 150 pounds and I was very overweight my whole childhood until that point. And so I lost my weight in a very mainstream way. Diet and exercise was not healthy. It was very extreme. Ate too little, exercised too much. But I really, I reached success in terms of the weight loss goal. And so that kind of came first. Then I met Nicole. And when I met Nicole, I had been struggling with IBS, so irritable bowel syndrome. And it all seemed kind of random. But at the time, I had already been doing some mind-body work, really for the purpose of maintaining my weight, so I wasn't overeating anymore. And then when I met Nicole and I started doing some of this journal speak, mind-body work, meditation, etc., to heal my IBS, that's how I really got into this work and connected with Nicole. But what was going through my head when I said, what about after the after picture, is because I feel like that's what the last few years have been for me. I lost all my weight when I was in college. And so it's been about a decade or so since all that weight came off. And I've been really settling into what life is like and what the world is like and what society is like in a much smaller body than I grew up in. And it has just been, it's a journey. It's an experience, and it really, really never ends. And so what feels really important to me is, time and time again, whether it's with the clients that I work with around overeating, emotional eating, weight gain, or it's the clients that I have who have done this work, who are familiar with journal speak and have healed even their chronic pain symptoms, and then start working with me around food, et cetera. What I see over and over and over again is, when is it going to end? Right. When is it going to be over? When is it going to be over? When is it going to be over? And whether that's overeating, binge eating, undereating, compulsive dieting, whether it's mindless eating, whatever it is, it's just, when can this be over? And that's where I feel you and I really connect, in just standing in that position of, it's not going to be.
Exactly. I was going to jump in and say, you know, for your line of work, it's all around food and eating and body image. But in my line of work, it's everything. Yeah. When am I going to not feel uncomfortable anymore? When am I going to not have these headaches? Or once the headaches are gone, why is my knee hurting? You know, and I tell people, there's no cure for the human condition. So how can we learn to partner with our mind-body system and accept that sometimes we feel things in our heart and sometimes we feel things in our body, and it's fluid and it's beautiful and it's the reason we're here?
Yeah. Yes, exactly. And I mean, the amount of times that I quote you in what hurts worse, and there is no cure for the human condition, because that's what this work is. And I've seen so many times that when I'm working with someone and we really start to figure out and heal in many ways the relationship with food and body image, the things that pop up when things around food feel safe and healthy and stable, the other areas that kind of were swept under the rug of the relationship with food and the things that I've seen around, you know, now I'm really struggling with my job and my work and my boss. I'm struggling in my marriage with my kids. I'm struggling with alcohol and other substances. There's other struggles that have been kind of swept under it. And that's exactly the point here, is that we put a lot of eggs in the basket of food and weight and really tell ourselves, and I've done the same thing, that when I heal this, I will be done. And so that's the thing, is that's what I keep encountering, not just again in my personal experience, but professionally working with people, is when we can really work on the food, the other things pop up. Mm-hmm. And that's why for me, it's about, we're using the relationship with food that we have just as the mechanism through which we learn how to reparent ourselves. The relationship with food is an opportunity to learn how to get your needs met, how to really listen to your body, how to listen to what your body's trying to communicate to you. And so really for me, it's about, you know, having a struggle with food, sure, but using that as the opportunity to learn how to take care of yourself. And because once you know how to listen to your body, how to get your needs met, it's not about food. You take that into the issues that come up in your relationships, in your job, with your kids, with alcohol and other substances, with everything else, because it's all the same. It's the human condition.
So let me ask you a question. Talk to me about your understanding and your relationship with the concept of before and after, with the concept of, you know, the before picture. I said, we were talking before we came on the air, and I was like, you know, we live in a before and after society. It's all you see in People magazine. Back in the 90s, it was all you saw in Oprah. It was a society of look how she was and look how she looks now. We live in a makeover society. We live in I think it was a TikTok trend during quarantine, you know, how it started and how it's going. It's all we do because, and quite frankly, from a psychological perspective, I have great empathy for us as a culture wanting that, because there's an illusion within that philosophy that there is an end. Yeah. And in within that illusion is that the end will be the happy ending where now we don't have to feel or worry about anything anymore. And we're all looking for that. There's like a relief when you see the after picture, when you see the woman break through the paper onto the stage and like, oh my God, you know, not only is she 100 pounds less, but her hair looks better and her makeup looks better. And it's tempting. Like I really want to bring connection to how appealing it is to believe in that, but it's also such a setup and such a trap. So how would you characterize your relationship with this whole before and after society?
Yeah. So to your point, I mean, when I started my weight loss, I was 17. And what happened to me was, so I was overweight my whole life. I have no memories of not being overweight, using the medical term, for my entire childhood. And so I was 17. I graduated high school in 3 years and I was taking a gap year traveling around. And what happened was I was in the airport in Australia. And it was the first time that I could barely fit myself into a bathroom stall. And I kind of just had that moment where I sat down and thought to myself, I'm 17 years old, I'm 300 pounds, and I really deserve a life that doesn't look like this. I deserve to be able to move with comfort and breathe and travel and live. And so that was the beginning of really, in a serious way, considering that maybe I wanted to lose weight for myself, you know, versus being forced by my parents or doctors and other things that I experienced during my childhood. And so that's where it started for me, was, okay, now I felt like I had, you know, the fire lit under me a little bit, and I was ready. And so the way that it worked in my head was simply before and after. This is where I am now. This is how I look. This is what I weigh. This is what it is. And this is how it impacts my life. And this is how limited I am. And after, it's going to be like this. And it's going to look like this and feel like this. And I won't be limited in these ways. And I just kind of shut my eyes and moved forward and said, yeah, this is it. And so the understanding that I had at the time was, you know, kind of what we were just saying, is that I will lose all this weight and I will get to the end of my weight loss and I will be done. I will be totally done. I will be finished. I will be complete. This is the only problem that I have to solve, and it will be solved. This is, yeah, right. This is the,
aww,
this is
I
the
love
only,
you though. I know, I right?
And
that,
right? And I am so cute. Like, I think about that 17-year-old, right? And
yes,
she knew everything in the world. She knew everything, and it was just, I know what I'm doing. I know how this ends, and this is going to solve everything. And, you know, at 17, had no capacity for what what that meant. You know, even hearing it in myself, I fully believed it. You know, what other problems do I have? And that was, you know, really the cool thing about me as a kid was my body didn't stop me. I was, you know, physically it stopped me from riding roller coasters and sitting in restaurant booths and all of those things. It stopped me there physically, but it didn't stop me socially. I was very, you know, proud and loud and comfortable and popular and very social. And I was, you know, the life of the party. And so for me, I really was convinced that if I lose my weight, I will be perfect. I will be the perfect person at the end of this.
Oh, I just love you for that. I love it.
So yeah, it's so cute. And so that's really what it was when I started. And that's why, and that's part of why it was so extreme, was because, you know, this was all I needed. And so it became, how do I lose as much weight as fast as I possibly can? There was no consideration of health. There was no consideration of listening to my body. I didn't know what that meant or how to do that or that was a thing. I just knew to eat less and exercise more. And so I did. And then I got to the end, right? And so the end of my weight loss, which if you've heard the first two podcasts, you know, really, I had swung the pendulum all the way to the other side. And so now instead of eating too much, I was eating too little. Instead of exercising too little, I was exercising too much. And I lost my period. My hair was falling out. I was freezing all of the time. I was really sick and malnourished and starved. And it was a nutritionist who eventually brought that to my awareness when I hit a weight loss plateau, by the way. That was the biggest concern and the only thing that would get my attention. And so really that was the beginning of me having to tune in and say, how did I swing this pendulum so far and get so far on the other side of the spectrum? And now I had to come back. And so I would say that's why for the last decade, really, it's been about what happens after the after picture. Was I was the after picture and I achieved what, you know, I thought I was going for. But then I was really sick and unhealthy, and there were a lot of side effects to that. And so, and ironically, at the time, it was right after my weight loss, I actually got an email to be on the cover of People magazine for the Happier Size issue. Yeah, you don't know that story.
I didn't know that.
And I was actually on semester at sea. And while I was abroad, it was my junior year in college, and I just got an email from People magazine. And I don't remember, you know, why it like ended up not working out, but I ended up, you know, I wasn't on that. But the whole point is that at that point in my life, I was a walking after picture. And part of my time while I was at the University of Michigan, while all this weight was coming off of me, the overwhelm of not just now being seen, but getting an incredible amount of attention. Like,
right, positive people, attention.
Oh my God. I mean, people, yes, it was my friends, it was my acquaintances, but it was people I didn't even know. It was people, like I had people, you know, coming up to me at football games on Saturdays, like, you're Lisa Schlossberg, like you're the girl that lost all the weight. And so that happened very, very fast. And it was extremely overwhelming for me. And I had no idea why. And this is why I think this is important to talk about, is because at the time, the way that I think about it now was I was so high on the drug of external motivation or external validation.
Right.
That I had no idea what was going on inside of me. And that's the thing here that matters to me. That is, we get, or again, I speak for myself, I got so just swept up in being successful, in being the achiever, in being accomplished, in being in having willpower that other people don't have in right. all of that, you know, in the strength that it must have taken me that other people don't have, you know, all that kind of, I have this thing in me and it makes me better and therefore safe and okay and all of that. And the reason that I felt or got so unhealthy and sick was because my body was talking to me the whole time. My body was sending me messages for months and months and months that I was not eating enough and I was exercising way too much, but it didn't matter. I didn't hear any of it. I paid no attention to myself or my internal experience because nothing was worth, you know, I remember what it felt like to wake up. And this is why I think when it's something, you know, when it's your body, it's not a substance, it's not a relationship, it's not a, you know, it's not your job that you go to and from every day, it's your body, you're living in it. And at the time, I remember I would like jump out of bed and I felt literally high on life. I felt high on life because that's how I walked around. Right. Everywhere I went, Schloss, you look amazing, you look amazing, you're amazing, you're amazing, you're amazing. All day, every day. And it just got so loud. That was the only thing I could hear. And I didn't pay any attention to, you know, the whispers of the body being very, very clear about what it needed. And so that to me is what I've really been paying attention to the last few years in myself is, who am I when I'm not defined by that? Who am I actually?
Wow. Thank you for sharing that. That's a really powerful story. And I haven't heard it in exactly that way, even though you and I have spoken so often about this and everything. So I want to fast forward a little bit, because the way you just told that actually gives me more insight into your story that I do know, mm-hmm. which is you lost all that weight in a really unhealthy fashion. You hit a wall with the lack of period, hair falling out, malnourished thing. You got yourself, you know, healthier because it was a requirement or else you were going to die. So you did what you had to do. And when I met you, you had been doing for several years, you know, other sort of mind-body modalities in order to keep the weight off. Because I think intuitively you knew, maybe you hadn't found the exact thing needed, but intuitively you knew you can't just stay where you are if you don't look at what's really going on. Because yeah. even though you sew in such a lovely, lovely, innocent way, thought my entire problem is my weight. And once I get that settled, I'll be perfect, put a bow on it, shine it up. We're going to live this way for the rest of our lives with not a concern. You know, that was so lovely. And I think you started understanding that that's not really true. Plus, you know, age and maturity gives us that slap in the ass, unfortunately. And so you were doing, I think, really great work in terms of knowing that the mind and the body were connected, knowing that your heart needed to be heard as well as how many calories were, you know, in a grilled cheese sandwich. Mm. But I want to say something that I remember. When I first met you, you had mentioned your IBS, and I want to clarify this, but in my understanding at the time, you didn't think that your IBS factored into this. Would that be correct?
Correct.
I love that though, because that's yeah. like such a teachable moment and such, yeah. and the reason we're sitting here. So talk about that a little bit, about how IBS was something that I know it began on Semester at Sea. You did discuss it. You can recap if you'd like, mm-hmm. whatever you think. And that how it was living so separately of this entire journey.
Yeah. Yeah. Great question. So I went on Semester at Sea. So I lost all my weight my sophomore year of college, and then junior year I went on Semester at Sea, which
it's a
study abroad program on a ship. And so I was living on a ship that traveled, it left from California and went to Japan, and we went all through Asia and Africa and landed in Europe. So I had traveled the world in 5 months, literally. That's what Semester at Sea was. And so I was on Semester at Sea, and toward the end of that journey, we were in Ghana. And while we were in Ghana, I was actually quarantined with diarrhea. That was the official diagnosis at the time. And I remember feeling just absolutely astonished at how sick I could feel for like 48 hours. And so the reason I share that is because my stomach after that had never been the same. Like, I left semester at sea, everyone kind of, you know, any digestive issues that may have come up along the way kind of settled for everyone else. And that's when my IBS really, really began, was when I came home. And this is where I went through, I did all the Western medicine, everything. I had all the tests done. I tried medications. I tried this and that, and everything came back normal. So my diagnosis officially was post-infectious IBS, which basically, you know, was my doctor saying, you did have an infection while you were away. And basically our best guess is that you have IBS because of that, somehow lingering.
I'm sorry to laugh, but this is where I get a little bit, a tiny, tiny little bit. How can I use the word? The word condescending keeps coming up. And so I wish I could find a better word for my brain, but it's like, I look at the medical model and I go, really?
Yeah.
Really? Like, she had an infection 6 weeks ago that is completely resolved, but we guess that's why you're going to be in pain for the rest of your life in your stomach. Like, it just, it bothers me, but I guess people are doing the best they do, you know?
Yes. And I mean, I may have said this on the previous podcast, but I remember really at the time, and this was something that I heard you say at one point that really resonated, that was like, irritable bowel syndrome, that's my diagnosis. I came in telling you I had an irritable bowel. Like, that's not an answer. Like, that's the problem. So yes, exactly. And that's, and 6 weeks, it was like a year later, they were like, this is probably post-infectious IBS. It was like, so I had tried all the things, you know, and by the time we met, I, again, it's like so funny to think about. The way that I thought about it was exactly, my weight loss was wrapped up in a nice little bow, and I would never have any problems for the rest of my life, right? So, and at the time, which I think really fills out the picture, what was I doing with my life? I was a personal trainer at a corporate gym on Long Island in New York. So I was just living that life of, you know, walking through the gym and being the expert, being the authority, being the success story. That was the life that I was living at the time. And so when I eventually kind of was introduced to your work and all of this, I was very, I was upset that I was disappointed that I had a problem again.
Right. How dare you, right? Have a problem?
Yeah, like, this sucks that, and not only do I have a problem, I knew I had a problem, but I had a problem I had to take responsibility for. That's the difference. We have problems all the time, but if you're going to the doctor and seeking, expecting, you know, surgery, medication, et cetera, because you have a problem, but you don't want to take responsibility for it. Well, someone else is helping you take care of that. Someone else is taking care of that. But this, the reason that it was uncomfortable and I didn't want to admit it, and I wrestled with it for a little bit before really letting you into my head, that was, but if this is my problem, it means that I have to do something about it.
It means you are the solution. And that is a really scary, honestly, and once again, I want to bring connection. Like, we can laugh about it all we want, but, you know, there's a lot of people listening to this podcast that are suffering and probably tipping right on that edge that you're talking about, where the resistance is strong when we realize no one's coming to save us, that we are the solution. And it's both incredibly empowering and incredibly optimistic and a relief, and it's also really shitty news.
So that's what it was for me, was it felt like a totally different thing. And I had to really, I mean, I could just feel it. Like, it was like wrestle until I just totally give up. Like, you know, the 5-year-old throwing a temper tantrum. I don't want to. Okay, I guess you're right. And that's kind of what it was when I first heard you speak. It was like, no way. No. Mm-mm. And then, you know, I heard enough and was like, ah, you know, and what still to this day always resonates with me is that question you ask, that is, how long do you want to suffer? It was mm-hmm. just, it was just that. It was just, Lisa, tell the truth. How long do you want to suffer? And when I kept hearing that, it was kind of like, you know, your move, Lisa, what are you going to do? And it was just like, okay, fine. Surrender to this. And so that's what it was for me. But I do also feel really called to take this as an opportunity to clarify or to just inform around what I have seen over and over and over again, because I think it can be helpful, because not everyone struggles with food, but everyone eats food.
Right.
Everyone has a relationship with their body, whether they're aware of it or not, because they're living in it. So even though, you know, I work with people who are struggling around food and eating in their bodies, this is not just for those people. That is what I've seen over and over again is when I'm talking about, you know, the work I do, and it's any kind of struggle relationship with food, any kind, manifests in so many different ways. When it comes down to really doing the work, a lot of the time the resistance, I think, this is just a personal theory, is like it comes back to when we were kids, for most of us, this is not true for all of us, but for most of us when we were kids, we just showed up at the table and food was put on the table. And all we had to do was show up and eat it. And that was our job as a kid. And at a certain point in life, no one was putting food on the table anymore. And we all had to figure out, where is that food going to come from? What's right. it going to be? Who's going to prepare it? Who's going to put it on the table? Who's going to clean it up? Who's going to do food? And I think it's a really, really important point, because sometimes we peel off layer after layer after layer. And I've heard the same resistance over and over and over again. That is, I just don't want to. I just don't want to pay attention to food. I don't want to think about what I'm eating. I don't want to meal prep. I don't want to put the work in to be healthy. I just don't want to. Can't someone else do it for me? And that's when we just peel it all off and we really give that inner child a voice. Very often that's what it's saying is, can't we just have someone else do this? It's so much work to be healthy. And I think the reason that we feel that way is A, because it is valid.
Right. It is.
And B, because we grew up not having to be our own parent around food and around
eating. Or around anything.
Or around anything. But exactly. Yeah. It's for me, it's about, you don't have an issue with food. You have the problem of, you have to take responsibility for things. You have to adult. You have to be a parent. And that's the tough blow. The same tough blow that it was for me to say, my IBS means that I can take responsibility and I can do work and I can be the solution for myself and I can heal. And again, like you said, it's uncomfortable. No one wants to really own that. But when you own that, everything you want is yours.
It's right? The beginning.
It's the beginning of everything. Yeah. And so that's why I just think it's so important that if at any point you're really struggling in your relationship with food, if there's a part of you that is just so pissed off that you have to be responsible for your own health, that's very valid. Yeah. And being in that place, you know, being in the temper tantrum is not helping. It's not making you healthier. It's keeping you where you are. It's a choice between what hurts and what hurts worse.
Does that make sense? Someone really smart says that usually. No, I hear you 100%. And I think the point that you make, you know, obviously you're coming from your expertise, which is this whole eating food and body image thing and relationship with one's body and with food. But it really applies what you're saying to everything.
Yeah.
Because when I meet people, you know, I used to joke around that when I used to have a private practice and people would say, you know, what usually is the story of people before they show up at your door? And I'm like, show up at my door? You mean before they crawl through my door with their face on the floor like a military crawl? Because people would do anything other than do this work.
Yeah.
And when they finally surrendered, which is exactly what you said, when they somewhere in the midst of their temper tantrum had what you might call a spiritual awakening or whatever it is and said, hold on. I see what's going on here. I'm like stepping outside of myself and watching myself on the floor kicking and screaming. I'm realizing that I have a decision to make and I can take back my power. And people, they do it with everything. And yeah. And in terms of bringing connection and bringing validation to the fact that we don't want to do what we need to do if it makes us feel uncomfortable.
Yeah.
And what often keeps us going is this concept of the before and after. Because if we can just look toward the after and say, okay, I'm going to do what I need to do here because I might one day look like that, whether that is a person who's half their size or whether that's a person who's, you know, running the marathon after having had horrible knee pain, you know. And I want to just also say that there is a place for this. It just can't be the end of the story. I spend this whole podcast interviewing people as success stories. I believe we need success stories for all those little temper tantruming parts of ourselves that need motivation. It's okay to know that success is out there, but it is equally important, which is why we're having this conversation, to know that there is life after the after picture. And we need to know what that is, because without that, we will be in the face of constant disappointment. And honestly, living in the face of failure, because if we're expecting everything to be perfect, then we're Lisa, half her size, walking around going, I can't fucking believe I have IBS now. I was just about to be perfect. Perfection was at the door. And here I am. What the hell? What the actual F? So, sorry. When I'm hanging out with my friends, I get even worse with the F-bombs. I'm trying to control myself. Nicole, rein it in, girl. So, okay, so Lisa.
Yeah.
Talk to me a little bit about your journal speak journey, because I don't even know the answer to this question, but all I know is I get these like these one-off, pingy, euphoric, like, oh my God, I had the epiphany of a lifetime. So explain to me like what's been going on the past few months. Like, tell me what's going on. Yeah.
Okay. So many things. But I think truthfully, what I said in the last podcast, something that I was talking about was the story of right after your Omega retreat, where I'm speaking on stage all about this work, and then I go home and I end up in the ER yes. for a night, right, with my on fire stomach. And I had felt like I had felt all kinds of stomach discomfort. And that was just like another level. And so I went to the ER. I was in so much pain. And then I think the diagnosis was gastritis. And at the time, I remember being like, great, TMS. Like I know. Like, this means that I know that this is more of the same thing. And so that was a big moment, because what that then led me to was pen to paper. I think the most powerful thing that came out then was my inner child, very loud and clear, communicating to me, you never let me out.
Yes.
I was very clear on what that meant, because I was just flashing back to all these times in my life where I was really, you know, sad. And I pretended that I wasn't. I was anxious. I pretended that I wasn't. I was lonely and scared and all of these things. And I pretended that I wasn't. And that was just the way that I lived. That is the way that I grew up as a kid. And again, that's why I was 300 pounds instead of feeling and expressing my feelings, I was eating them. And that's what made me feel okay. But that was a big moment for me then. That was, you never let me out. And really seeing in myself that what I needed was to just really be with the parts of me that were really vulnerable, sad, anxious, et cetera, not in control, not perfect, all of that. And so that's what it was before moving to California. And that was, oh my God, that was almost 2 years ago in a few months.
How crazy.
I know, like, it's insane. So that was almost 2 years ago. And what has happened since? Well, I will say that my journal speak practice has been a huge component of the past 2 years. Will be for the rest of my life. And I think one of the bigger things that I've noticed in the last year or so with myself is that I think that moment really cracked me open in a lot of ways, so that a lot of the healing and transformation and connection has happened not just on the page. And that's what I've started to experience, is what happens after the after picture. What happens, you know, it's not just those big kind of moments on the page. It's the life.
Yeah.
It's that my feet touch the yoga mat and I'm downloading something, like, from the universe. I'm taking a walk. I'm in nature. I'm with my friends. I'm listening to music. That's the thing, is that, you know, in my mind, what I may have had as a quote after picture was healing IBS. And the reason it's so important to talk about what happens after the after picture is because healing IBS is the smallest part of it,
right?
You know,
I always say it's the biggest, littlest part. Yeah,
yeah. It's really like what IBS? You know, it's like I forgot that there. You know, because what it became for me, and I can only speak for myself, but what it became for me is just really an understanding of, I am a spiritual being having a physical experience, and my body is always talking to me. But that's the thing, is where it went was everywhere. It just feels like it, like, cracked me open. And so what does that actually mean? Well, I feel like it's a combination of emotional and intelligence. it's emotion and it's intelligence. It's being able to really be with myself where I am. Self-acceptance. Not fighting what is. I think we talk all about, you know, what is acceptance? Acceptance, and we've both said this, especially about when it comes to weight or food and eating and all that stuff, is first accept where you are. And that doesn't mean like it. It doesn't mean you're comfortable. It doesn't mean you want to stay there. It just simply means that you're not fighting it. And I feel like a lot of this work has allowed me to live that way, that I'm not just not fighting my IBS, but I'm not fighting traffic. I'm not fighting the weather.
Right.
I'm not fighting the human condition, the human experience. And that's what I think the big thing is that I have lived, I've really created a world in myself where I felt like I had a lot of control, or I felt like I needed a lot of control. And what I realized over the past couple of years is one side effect of feeling like I always need to be in control is that it's really I tend to blame myself for everything. and so that's the thing, is it's a way of keeping the control, right? Or the illusion of control, I should say.
Right.
And so to really be with that is, you know, what if actually the traffic, I'll go with that example. Clearly, I moved to California.
Yeah.
That's right. Like, if that's the example, I would, left alone, I would somehow, not consciously, find a way to blame myself for it. I should have left sooner. I should have known.
Right,
I should have this. I should have that. And it's the more I do this work, the more I have these moments where it's kind of like that. Like, you pull yourself out of the temper tantrum and you're like, is this my fault? Like, really? We're good. And those moments of, you know what? Sometimes things are uncontrollable, and sometimes things are hard, and sometimes things are uncomfortable, and I don't need to do anything about that. I don't need to fight that. I don't need to change that. I can just be in it and say, wow, sometimes things are uncomfortable, and sometimes they're not. And that's what it is after the after picture, is that it's really freedom. You know, being an after picture is not freedom. Being, you know, holding yourself to that standard, I should say, is the farthest thing from freedom. But I feel like that's what it's been for me over the last couple of years is, you know, what if we're not defining ourselves by that image, by the expertise, by the credentials, by the, you know, the bells and whistles? What is underneath? And what is underneath is a thinking, feeling, being.
So I want to say something about what you're expressing. So I think that what's really, really impactful here as I'm listening is that we're all looking to, let's use a cliche, live our best lives, right? That's like a very hashtag living my best life. So you know, wouldn't it be nice if we could get there? And I believe we can. And so it reminds me, we can like hearken back to undergrad psychology, of Maslow's hierarchy of needs. So for the most of you who don't know what that is, Maslow is a theorist, and he had this thing that kind of looked like the food pyramid, actually. And it was a hierarchy of needs. And like, I don't remember all of them, but I know that the bottom one, so it's like the widest base of the pyramid, is basic needs. We need food, we need shelter, we need, you know, a community. Like, I don't even know if community goes in there. Literally, you need to like not die. So that's the bottom. And the very tip, toppy of the pyramid is self-actualization. And there's lots of stuff in between. But the reason that this is coming up for me as you're speaking is because what Lisa's talking about is really knocking on the door of self-actualization. It's really knocking on the door of no longer being confined by the limits of your fear, and no longer being defined by your past, and being able to have perspective, and being able to have an observational self. I mean, this is the goal. Hashtag goals. And having said that, how do you get there? You know, how do you get to self-actualization in Maslow's hierarchy? Well, you got to start with staying alive. Yeah. You got to start with being fed, water, shelter, clothing. And then and if you can achieve that, you have the energy to step up to the next hierarchy, you know, the next and the next. And so what I'm hearing is that the way to get to what we want has to begin, you have to start where you're at. And if indeed you out there is a person who has a diagnosis, an affliction, a condition, a fatigue, a depression, and anxiety, it doesn't really matter. It's the door through which you're on this journey. It's the biggest, littlest part, but it's got to start big, just like the base of a pyramid has to be big. It's got to be everything to allow you to walk through the door and start this work. And then as you do it through your resistance, as you do it through your temper tantrums, as you do it through your own best thinking saying, nah, you're too tired. No, you got something else to do. Who needs it? As you continue to do it, even through all of those voices, you start moving up the pyramid. And it's the only way to get there. You know, we can't snap our fingers and say, oh, I'm going to be, you know, one with the heavens and I get it all and I understand. Like, it's our little spaces inside of us, the place where the inner child is suffering, they need to be attended to first.
Yeah.
And so what are some of the epiphanies, if you will, along the way that have been most meaningful for you?
Read your text. Okay. I can't quantify or even identify, because they just drop in and it's everything. But I think one of the big things that feels really important is that, and I think specifically probably for the people that are listening, the people that we work with, is many of the people, at least that I work with, have some sort of practice, maybe they dabble in meditation, or they've done some journaling, or maybe they like yoga or something like that. And, you know, they're there in some ways that they're practicing some of these things. And I would say one of the most important things to me about all of this work that I think could use some explicit conversation around is a lot of these tools and skills really do help us manage on a day-to-day basis and kind of help us be with where we are. But what I'm saying is there is a difference between, for me, I'll use myself again, there's a difference between managing the anxiety and feeling it.
Right.
And to me, there is a difference even between, to me, that's the difference between journaling and journal speaking. There is a difference between talking about the emotion and feeling the emotion. And so when I think about just what are the helpful tidbits, you know, listening to this, quote, how do we get there? I think it's so important to know that it's the way that I think of it is like it's like a two-step process. It's like a dual approach of increasing the feeling of safety in the body and with the self. So things like, you know, meditation, things like grounding and breathing, things like a healthy, compassionate inner dialogue, all of those things are going to create an internal environment of safety. And we need that. And on top of that, we also need to expand our capacity to feel fear. Yes. Because when I think about it's like we have to build on the safety, but we also have to build on the fear. Because I think about just, you know, mainstream eating disorder treatment that and again, nothing about the treatment, but just the idea of, okay, so we know in theory, eating disorder is very related to control. And where a lot of that ends up going is, so what are the things we need to take control over? And to a degree, yes, right? Like what we just said, you do have to have a part in your health, in your finances, in your life. You do need to have control over the things you can control. But there are always going to be aspects of your life that are not controllable. There are going to be the people and the places and the things and the weather and the traffic. And if those are the things that then have you turning to food or a substance or any other behavior that, you know, just to cope with the fact that the human condition is uncontrollable. Well, to me, it's not about finding safety. It's actually about what you said to me on the phone months ago when I called you in crisis and you said to me, Lisa, you are someone that feels safe when you have answers.
Yeah.
And you're not going to have safety anytime soon.
Right.
Do you remember, I remember that?
Yes. Right? I'm the same as you, by the way. So
right. Because you know me and I can take that and I can hear that and I know what you're saying. But it's so important to me. Because that's the thing is that we're all like in that, you know, in that place, like, how do I get to safety? How do I get to safety? How do I get to safety? And I think a lot of our anxiety collectively is trying to get to safety because what if, you know, we all had that conversation that was just, you're not going to get to safety. What are you going to, you know, how do you want to be?
What now?
Yeah. Who do you want to be when you don't have safety? Who is the person that you want to be? How does she behave? That's where I take it is, okay, great. I don't like this. I'm certainly uncomfortable here. But if I don't get what I want and I can't do what I want to do, who is the person that I want to be? How am I going to operate in this the way that I want to be? If I leave it to myself, well, shit, I don't want to be here. But if I can just kind of outsource to the higher self, that's the way I think about it. What do I have to do? And then it's just be where I am. Be in the discomfort, be in the endless questioning and the racing thoughts and the, oh my God, this is a catastrophe and it'll never end and I'll never be okay. Just be in that. And the answer is yes. And right. It's remarkable what happens. And that I think again is, it's an epiphany that I have over and over and over and over again because it never ends. But it just gets, you know, like more and more welcoming with time is to say, oh, discomfort. Well, okay. I've done this. I don't like it. It can be hard. But as long as I know that the next right move is take a deep breath and stay still, well, then I have what I need because right. I have the answers, right? That's the answer in that moment.
How old are you again?
Well, it's a funny thing you ask because between the time that we record this and the time that we release this, I will have another birthday. So today I'm 27. When people are hearing this, I'll be 28.
Dude, were you this smart at 27? I wasn't. Holy shit. You're amazing. That's amazing things. You're saying amazing things. And I, you know, you're 27? What the hell with you? What the hell is going on in the brain of Lisa Schlossberg? Okay. So that is all just so on point. It's so on point, guys. What if there was no safe? What did you want to say?
You remember my ball slam story?
Yes. That sounds bad, but yes.
I feel like I should tell it because I feel like it's the To me, I go back to that. I'm just going to tell it. You can cut it out if you want to.
No. Tell it. And can you call it a medicine ball so no one thinks we're talking about
– Oh, my God.
Ball slam?
Yes. Okay. All the personal trainers out there know what I'm talking about. But, so it's the medicine ball story. And the reason that I bring that up is because – You know, it's funny that I was putting this in speeches like 3 years ago, and it wasn't until even you heard it and you were like, this, Lisa,
yeah,
this.
I love that. Yeah.
And I was like, you know, even at the time I was like, it's like a good story, but, you know, speaking to what are the epiphanies I've had over the last few years, it's like every so often I'll be like, this is why she said that. Okay. You know, I was saying things I didn't fully even see the magnitude of at the time, but what that was.
Well, actually, let me then just preface your story by saying Lisa did a talk at NYU and she sent me the recording of it. And I had heard her speak. I forget, was this before or after you spoke at Omega at my retreat? Before, right?
I don't know.
All right, it doesn't matter. So you sent me that speech and I watched the whole thing, and this story that she's about to tell you was in that talk, and I freaked out over it. I literally called her and I'm like, that's the story. No, it must have been before Omega, because I was like, that's the one I want you to tell on stage at my retreat.
Yeah.
And I think you were kind of like, okay, why?
Yeah.
You know? And I said, because that story is everything.
Yeah.
And so go ahead and tell it.
Okay. So my dad died on February 2nd and my birthday is March 25th. And so it was the year that he died and 3 years ago, and it was on my birthday. And so it was right after, you know, it was a month and a half after he passed away, and my dad was my person. And he had been sick with early onset dementia. So he was sick for years before he actually died. And I could not fathom at all how I was supposed to continue going on with life without him. And so it was my 25th birthday, and I went to the gym just for mental health reasons. And then I remember I came home from the gym. And I was a personal trainer at the time, and I had a home gym where I was training my clients, and I had a 14-pound medicine ball in my basement. And I got back from the gym and I just felt so not complete. I feel like I didn't get out emotionally, mentally, the energy that was in me that I needed. And so I went home and it was a really bad day. It was like my plans were getting messed up and my boyfriend made a mistake and my friends were messing up and like everything just sucked. And my dad was dead. And I just could not believe that I was turning 25 and it was the worst day ever. And that I was doing this without my dad. So I went home and the only thing that I could do was pick up the medicine ball and just slam it into the ground over and over and over again until I couldn't breathe. And then I just sat on it and sobbed. And then as soon as I could catch my breath again, I picked up the medicine ball and I just slammed it into the ground over and over and over again until I couldn't breathe. And then I sat on it and sobbed. And I just went back and forth. I don't know how long or how many times that I was just slamming this anger and rage into the ground and then sitting in a puddle of grief. And I remember thinking to myself, I'm going to die here.
Yeah.
There is no way that something can be so, so painful and not fatal. There is no way that I can feel what I'm feeling and not be completely taken out by this. I'm going to die here. And then I remember the most miraculous thing happened when nothing happened. And I remember just opening my eyes and catching my breath and realizing in that moment that I made it.
Yeah.
And that I was alive and that somehow. And I, what really sticks out to me now was I remember being surprised. Like I was genuinely shocked that
you were still alive.
That yeah. I was alive. Like yeah. I literally was like, there's no fucking way that I'm like looking through these eyes, you know? And then I was. And then I just, and it was just like, I could feel like my heart rate coming down and my breath coming back and me kind of coming back onto earth and just collecting myself in one piece. And truly, 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 my life has never been the same because I survived.
Yes.
And that's everything.
And that is the reason that, and I'm sure everyone out there is feeling the impact of that story. And the reason I heard that story and I said that one is because that story is about journal speak.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah.
And that's why I say to me, the difference between journaling and journal speak is about feeling it, not just telling the story, not just writing the words, not just recalling it in your memory, but being it, but embodying it, feeling it. That is what journal speak is about. And that is why, you know, it happens on the page and then it happens off the page
mm-hmm.
because you open yourself up to it, because you expand your capacity to sit in it and be in it and be with it and be it, that then you can do anything. To me, this is expanding the capacity to feel fear. Feeling safe in fear is the closest a human can be to invincible. When we can sit in fear, we can do anything. And that is what journal speak is about to me.
How old are you? How does someone get this wise at 27?
Stay tuned.
I know why. It's because you're almost 28.
Yeah, that's it.
Well, Lisa Schlossberg, I love you.
I love you.
You're my fave. You guys should have seen me pluck this girl. I saw you speak at this other healing retreat. It wasn't my retreat. I was there speaking, but you were one of the speakers. And I came up to her and I'm like, you, come over here. Come over here right now. She was like 12 years old. I said, come over here. You're mine. Come sit next to me. Lisa, I love you. I appreciate you. Thank you so much for being on the podcast today.
Thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure.
And for all of you guys out there, Lisa and I will be loud and proud on stage at the Omega Institute August 1st through the 6th. I can't wait.
Whoop. Same.
Oh, my God. I cannot believe we're going back.
I know.
I can't believe itching. The world is all opening. Year. World is opening. So if anyone wants to join us, I'll put the number in the intro. So you've already heard it. Cool. All right. Thank you again. And for everyone out there, this has been The Cure for Chronic Pain, one of my favorite episodes in all of the interviews I've done. Lisa, I love being with you.
Thank you. I love you.
All right, guys. Until next time, this has been The Cure for Chronic Pain with me, Nicole Sachs. See you then. Bye-bye.